Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and our seven-county listening area in central Iowa.
I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul.
Well, good morning, Susan, and all you listeners out there, too.
In the latter part of today's program, we'll bring you an update on the commercial movie theaters in our listening area. No movie previews, but a report on how they're getting along, including previews of what their stages are providing in the next month. Before we get to that, however, we're continuing our series, Candidates with Cal, with the new Libertarian Party's gubernatorial primary candidates that they'll have on their ballot. The first is Marco Battaglia, speaking with KHOI reporter Cal Halliburton.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with Mr. Marco Battaglia. Mr. Battaglia is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Libertarian Party nomination as a candidate for governor of Iowa. Mr. Battaglia was born, raised, and educated in Iowa. He graduated from Hoover High School and the University of Northern Iowa. Marco earned a bachelor's degree in communications and also studied political science and the Italian language. Marco has radio experience from working with Iowa Public Radio for 2 years and calls himself a jack of all trades, having professional experience in banking, insurance, and home mortgages. He currently writes for the Iowa Free Press and is a bassist for bands Dark Mirror, Speed Drum, and The Sleepover. He has been an active member of the state and national Libertarian Party for 5 years. Marco was a nominating delegate to the last national convention and has worked for a number of state and national political campaigns. He announced his campaign in the Iowa Press and within an Iowa State Fair straw poll, received the first ever Libertarian Party vote for the state of Iowa. Marco has one child in elementary school and owns an acreage on the south side of Des Moines. Marco, tell our listeners something about yourself that they'll not find on your website or with a search engine.
My mother actually came over via the Ellis Island route on a boat when she was very young, when she was a toddler. Her family brought her here from Italy. She was born in Modena in northern Italy. A couple of our family members came into Iowa and made a home in Madrid, Iowa, and then some of them went to Canada, and then there's some that are still in Italy.
As you talk with people across the state, what are their most frequent concerns?
A big one is what's going on with the income tax and the tax code in relation to the governor's tax plan and what the changes have been with the federal government, how that's going to impact Iowa. That's been a big one. The soil and water, the nitrate issue, having excess nitrates running off into the water and downstream, down into the ocean even. And another one has been an uptick in methamphetamine use and prescription medication. Those have been recurring themes. Mental health has been another one that nearly everyone I talk to of all across the political spectrum, all walks, want to see mental health addressed. And I was actually really happy to see it. We started off this kind of campaign season with a forum put on by the Des Moines Register on mental health. And I was there. The other Libertarian candidate was there and all of the Democrats. And at that time, the other Republicans, who now we know that it's just Reynolds that'll be left on the ballot. But back when they had a potential contested primary, it was all of us lined up there. And on a we really the whole field agreed on some things that I saw as very important on the topic of mental health. So that was kind of a positive of this journey so far.
Let's assume that you would get elected. What are some specific actions you can take to address those problems you've just mentioned?
Yeah, specifically the opioid problem. I'm very concerned with the way that current governance is handling that, both local, state, and even federal government. things like making it harder for people that do live in chronic pain to get opioids. I don't think that it's a well thought out solution, because sometimes people will get desperate and actually look to get their drugs somewhere else besides the doctor. So a lot of these deaths come from people mixing different kinds of medications, not following a doctor's recommendations, or even stepping into things like heroin that's unregulated. If they're in terrible pain, they might do anything they have to do. And that's far more dangerous than just allowing them to get the medication in a more straightforward manner. That, I think, we can address by kind of pumping the brakes on that. But there's also some scheduled substances that are currently scheduled or at risk of becoming scheduled, more heavily regulated by the government, that are helping people. I've talked to countless people since I announced. Kratom is one. It's a herb that basically just an alternative for pain relief. Some people use it to get off of opioids successfully, and some people just know they're at risk for abusing an opioid pain medication, so they would prefer it, or and some people just think it works better for them. There's also things like ibogaine is another plant-based item that people use that to help break an addiction, whether it be opioid or methamphetamine or heroin. Even smoking and drinking, I've heard people use that. So I think we really need to open up these things to science and fair study, as opposed to just prohibition and criminalization. And then even, you know, cannabis is a big issue right now. And I believe the one person in the race at this point that thinks we can see a full end to prohibition and let people utilize this plant in the near future, talking in the next couple of terms, as opposed to it being another 100 years or something of that nature. That's a lot of the heart of really how I think we could turn around the opioid situation rather quickly. And there's also a generic item called Naxalone that can actually turn around an opioid. If you're having an opioid overdose, can kind of shut that down. And by making that, it's a generic, relatively cheap drug, just spreading the knowledge that no one has to pass on from this kind of situation, making sure that first responders have it, making sure that police have the freedom to use it if they know about it is big. I mean, education is key. Making sure that police have the freedom to use it if they know about it is big. I mean, education is key. But I really think this is a situation where we have the tools we need to address this, and we almost need to let bureaucracy and get bureaucracy and the government out of the way and let people that want to help. There's another big thing going on there with some people that do choose to use other types of drugs. There's rates going up of hepatitis C and different things because of people sharing needles. And there's a community effort, and actually my personal representatives in government are for allowing these needle exchanges, where it's typically concerned citizens that are making sure if people are going to do this sort of thing, they have clean needles and they're not spreading, you know, exacerbating problems, making things worse. Mm-hmm. And I wholeheartedly support that. And I know my representatives that hear my voice, I've written them and they have responded that they're positive on that issue as well. They want to see it done. So that's good. The nitrates, that's another big one. I think that this definitely sets me apart from the field. I'm opposed to the renewable fuel standard that's, you know, our governor goes to Washington, D.C. to make sure that we're continuing to subsidize corn ethanol. And I think that science has proven that it is ineffective as far as being positive for the environment, and that it's really one of the failed biofuels. I'm a big believer in biofuel and competing alternative energy, working towards clean clean energy, but I think the subsidies get in the way of the market in terms of actually getting us there quicker is where I come from. Right now, so much of that corn that we plant is it goes to ethanol, and if you go to the corn producers' website, they'll tell you, I believe it's 60-some% is going to specifically ethanol, and that's a lot of monoculture that we would back away from if we didn't prop up that market. We'd have more varied fruits and vegetables. We'd have perennials. We'd have cover crops. Hemp is a big one. My whole life, I have been working to get us able to put hemp in our soil if we want to. And that's happening, I think, finally, federally. And the party that I'm a part of has been working for that since 1971. So it's really good to see some momentum there. I would be honored to be a part of helping that come to pass in Iowa. And that can actually act as a cover crop, which can drastically help if utilized in a sustainable manner that can help with the nitrate issue as well. I call it agricultural freedom myself, but it encompasses really a lot of things. That's the nitrate issue. I view mental health as a public safety issue. We can't help the most vulnerable among us. I would look at even increasing the funding for mental health. Let's get more beds, more access. Same with medications, more doctors having more freedom to use alternative treatments. Increasing funding with the intent of having these centers across the state. So 24 hours within 30 miles, you have somewhere you can go if you need help. Because someone going through some type of breakdown, they wind up in a hospital or a police station or an emergency room. And if they're not being treated appropriately, this is actually hurting, you know, everyone else that needs those services and exacerbating their problem. So if we have dedicated mental health that's available in transport to anyone in the state, that would be groundbreaking. And I believe my plan would actually encourage mental health professionals to flock here and want to practice here with the freedom we would give them. Yeah, during the course of my campaign, I raised money for a Passageway Mental Health Clubhouse in Des Moines, which I think we could look at that as a shining example to start that clubhouse model going in other communities across the state. Members and staff of a clubhouse work side by side to manage the operations, and they basically have this model that anyone that goes there, you're always going to get a place to return to, and you're going to be treated with respect and taught how to. Maybe you need help managing your condition so you can get a job, or just taking care of yourself for a while and cooking and making sure you can cook a nutritious meal. Mental health is so case by case, can vary so greatly that sometimes nutrition and a place to sleep does wonders for a person. Sometimes there's what's called a higher dosage of nutrients can actually work wonders for some people than just, you know, a normal meal that you might cook that would be healthy. I think mental health treatment is best given in the community that one resides. I believe in local, community-based, youth-driven answers to mental health treatment. And I think we can look to our neighboring states, Minnesota and South Dakota, and see that these things are working. I definitely believe we have the answers kind of staring us in the face.
Well, there are a few other issues. Folks have been talking about minimum wage needing a boost. Do you have a position on that?
I am actually concerned that Iowa minimum wage is seven-some dollars, and I truly feel as if very few employers would get away with paying someone that kind of wage if there wasn't a law telling them they could. So I'm almost more concerned that it's holding us back. And even the rates that they're attempting to raise the wages, I see a struggle even by 2022. If it was in the ballpark of $15-$17, I think we actually have to take a different approach and address inflation, address sound currency. I think we can improve the standard of living if we get Iowa on the forefront of sound economic policy and actually work on inflation as opposed to a wage. I'm concerned that a minimum wage is actually holding a lot of people back from making more money.
So would you repeal the minimum wage?
I would support that idea, certainly.
Another one of those issues, restricting money in Iowa politics, particularly money from outside interests. Do you have any position on that?
I can proudly say that I'm leading by example at this time, and I don't foresee that changing. I accept only donations from inside Iowa. I haven't taken any money from anyone that's not an Iowan that I haven't met and listened to, and they know my platform. You know, some of my largest donations have been like $500 from small business owner. That was from a small business owner in Ankeny. Well, everywhere I go, I see people wanting to get money out of politics, and candidates can do this now. Voters can do this now.
It's been our pleasure to be talking to Marco Battaglia, who's running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Libertarian Party nomination as a candidate for governor of Iowa. Thank you very much, Marco.
Thanks for talking to me, and thanks for doing what you're doing. I love radio. It's a passion of mine. And, yeah, I hope we can keep it going in Iowa for as long as I'm around and for my son's lifetime. So.
And thank you for listening, audience.
In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. You just heard a segment of our series, Candidates with Cal, where KHOI reporter Cal Halliburton interviewed Libertarian Marco Battaglia, one of the two gubernatorial candidates appearing on the Libertarian Party's ballot. To hear Jake Porter, the second Libertarian candidate for governor, listen to Friday's Local Talk. Even if you are committed to one of the two major parties, third parties are a way of learning about different perspectives in the political discourse. For the rest of the program, my usual co-host, Paul Wearson, will be joining us on a tour of the five movie theaters in our listening area. We made our first visits to those theaters 4 years ago when all new movies were being released only in digital format. This was a real crisis time for small-town theaters, and those in our listening area had a variety of ways to cope with that historic change. Therefore, we'll replay our interviews from 2014 with updates to let you know how those theaters are doing. I'm delighted that you've come from Story City today to co-host this show with me, Paul, because you're also a great fan of movies shown in local theaters.
You know, it's very personal to me because I started seeing movies at the Story City Opera House when I was just a little boy. And in retirement, I'm not only going to the movies, but volunteering for activities there at the theater, like the Story Festival and the annual stage musical production during Scandinavian Days. To really hear how that developed, as is developing, you need to hear from Todd Thorson.
We better hear from him at the end of the show, or you guys will talk about the Story City Opera House for the whole hour.
Yes, very possible.
Just to get started, I'd like to do a recap of how movies have affected our lives over the past 75 years by looking at one very special movie, a movie which was personally special to me, like probably millions of other people. It was released in 1939 as one of the full-length Technicolor movies. It was one of the very first. And when I was a child in the 1940s, I saw it as a feature film in the movie theater, the Junction Theater, across the street from where I lived in Junction City, Kansas. By 1960, when my children were little, it was occasionally still shown in movie theaters, but mostly it was available as an annual event shown on TV. Since we had black and white TV, we took our kids to Grandma's house to see it in color. By the 1970s, we went to a bar in Campustown here in Ames where we could watch it on a big screen TV, probably 45 inches, during its annual showing. And there it began to be a little cult thing. There were a lot of people who came to see The Wizard of Oz. By its 50th anniversary in 1989, the DVD of The Wizard of Oz became available, since many families had stopped going to movie theaters very often, and it was no longer shown annually on TV. I happened to return to my hometown at about that time, on the very day that the wrecking balls were demolishing the Junction Theater.
Well, that's a pretty grim story, for one. I think it's safe to say that just about everyone knows about The Wizard of Oz, probably thanks to television.
Yes, but the theaters themselves are important as places to gather and as symbols of community vitality.
We'll start our tour with Nevada's old theater, now called the Talent Factory, under the ownership of Cindy and Larry Sloan. Let's hear what Larry has to tell us about the history and what they're going to do there this summer.
Well, my wife and I, just about 2 years ago in November, bought the Camelot Theater in Nevada. And, of course, the Camelot is a wonderful historic building here in the what was or still is the county seat for Story County. And though the building was built in 1928 by Oscar Strine, the foundations go back to 1875. So there's a wonderful history here. The theater was built originally for vaudeville, for theater acts, as well as the new picture plays that were coming out. That's their term originally for movie theater. It was a picture play. So we fell in love with it and saw it was sitting in some disrepair and kind of falling apart and in the inside. The place was beautiful, but it definitely needed a lot of tender, loving care, a little TLC.
So you have a historic building to restore. Now, what did you say the original name of it was?
Well, the original name was actually the Circle Theater. It was named that by Oscar Strine. There were actually two other theaters in town that it put out of business, but it was just such a luxurious, almost opulent back in the day. It was the showplace of Central Iowa. It was a wonderful 440 seat theater. The balcony had reclining seats. They were the first reclining seats west of the Mississippi. It was really built for comfort. It's gorgeous inside. It was remodeled back in the 70s when Friedley took it over. And Friedley, of course, did it to a movie-only format back then. And they held on to it until 2002. So it's had a good long run.
So when they gave it up in 2002, then what happened? You didn't buy it right away, right?
No, it went through actually several owners. Friedley deeded it back to the city of Nevada. And the city of Nevada looked at it and evaluated it and said, gee, you know, it's going to need too much renovation. So the city then in turn sold it to a guy named Rob Bacon, who eventually became one of the state congressmen, state senators. And Rob ran it for several years and then tried to do movies. With the large theaters in Ames and the large multiplexes, it became very difficult to get first-run movies and make it affordable. Plus, the rates that movie theaters have to pay for their movies not only is just a base rate, but it's a rate that is sliding, because if the rate you paid to get the film is less than what you take in through the door, then they take 50% of what comes in through the door. So it's a very tough business. And well, that's one of the reasons why some of the concession prices are so high in large theater complexes, is they have to offset that take from the producers and the original companies, the distribution companies.
Does that mean you're not showing first-run movies there anymore?
No, we don't, actually. We did some. We tried some and found the rates we had to pay were just tough to make it on. So now what we do is we're a live entertainment venue.
What do you have in store for us this summer at the Talent Factory?
Well, coming up, we've got Carol Montag. She's going to be this weekend, Saturday, May 12th. And she does iconic folk music. Joni Mitchell, Judy Collins, Joan Baez, Carol King, just absolutely fabulous music that I love from the late 60s and 70s. Plus, she does a lot of her own music, so she writes. That's our first show coming up. Next, on Sunday, May 20th, we've got concert pianist Lori Line. And she's going to be doing her Simply Grand tour, and she'll be bringing in her concert grand piano. So we have to wrangle that up and onto the stage, 1,500 pounds of piano. So that'll be interesting. Then, of course, we have June 9th, Saturday, is Tonic Solfa. We had to cancel them back in April because of the snowstorm. So Tonic Solfa will be coming back on Saturday, June 9th. And, of course, they're a fabulous a cappella group. They're a Grammy Award-winning group. We love having them. They've been here before, and it's great music. Oddly enough, the next day, Sunday, June 10th, we have California Surf, Inc., and that's a group from California that's made up entirely of Beach Boys. This group is made up of Bobby Figueroa, Sterling Smith, Christian Love, Randall Kirsch, Ed Carter, and they don't just sound like the Beach Boys. They're the guys that made the Beach Boys sound, which I think is great. I love that music and looking forward to it. A week later after that, on Saturday, June 16th, we have Elvis Presley and Johnny Cash, two artists from Branson, and touring with the Dick Clark Legends in Concert. Paul Eve is Johnny Cash, and Joseph Hall is Elvis. Of course, they're both consummate artists. I think it's incredible the way Paul Eve looks like Johnny Cash. I mean, they're almost dead ringers. So that's cool. Then we've got Neil Diamond coming in, a guy from Branson again, Keith Allen. He's been voted best tribute artist doing Neil Diamond in the country. And that's going to be a great concert. I like Neil Diamond, and this guy he looks like him, and he sounds like him. That's just through the 1st of July.
But do you show movies at all at the Talent Factory?
And on occasions to private companies and such, we do allow them to show a movie, you know, to their own people. It's a private and show. But we do have the capabilities to show digital films or digital DVDs and Blu-ray and such as that.
Well, that's an interesting mix of ways to use the old building. And it sounds like anyone who's interested in the theater and how to make use of it should probably contact you.
Yeah, of course, it was originally, again, the Circle Theater. Then it became the Camelot when Freakley got it. It is still the Camelot building, but the Talent Factory is the company that we own and now owns the building. And they can get to us at www.iowatalentfactory.com.
Okay.
Go to our website and see everything that we're showing in there.
Well, thanks so much, Larry.
Well, now, Susan, this is just a great thing.
Yeah.
And very interesting from Larry. I remember going to the old Circle Theater when I was over in Nevada for the 4-H Fair. We'd walk uptown and go to the Circle Theater, and as I remember, there are sparkling stars in the ceiling or some sort of ornate stuff going on there. And I just wonder if that ceiling is still intact, because I remember going into that theater and seeing movies, and I was so fascinated as a boy of that beautiful blinking and sparkling ceiling. It's still imbued in my memory.
Well, Larry says it's still there.
Oh, good, good.
Our next guest was Terry Rojas of Webster City. We spoke with her 4 years ago, right after the dramatic opening of the Webster Theater. That event was the first step in confronting a crisis following the loss of two major businesses. In the succeeding years, I visited Webster City several times and have reported on a steady progression of new businesses, restaurants, and cultural activities led by homegrown community groups such as All Cultures Equal and Legacy Learning. Here's Terry to tell the story of how the people of Webster City saved their movie theater.
A pretty exciting time up here, and we just opened our doors 2 weeks ago. So, yeah, it's been a wild ride, and the whole community has gotten behind reopening the theater, and I think that's very exciting for us.
I think you need the backstory on that. What happened to the theater? Why was it closed? What happened to Webster City? Not everybody would know.
Well, the first thing that happened is that we lost a major employer, and hundreds of people were out of jobs. And in a town of about 8,000, when you lose a business that size, then it starts to affect your Main Street businesses as well, because people don't have money to spend. And so a year and a half ago, the theater filed bankruptcy and closed. And so it was one of 12 empty storefronts on Main Street. And I think the closure of the theater was like the final straw for some people, and they just decided that Webster City was not going to be written off as dying. I believe there was a TV station in Des Moines that actually reported that Webster City was dying, and that kind of fed into this. And so a group of people formed a nonprofit board to see if they couldn't buy the theater and get it reopened, and the name of the board is HERO, Help Entertain and Restore Organization. And we've had heroes all across Webster City at all levels. People have donated time and talent and money. And the first big thing was they restored the marquee, and it's just gorgeous. And then on the 19th, we opened our doors.
And what was the first movie that you showed?
We showed Guardians of the Galaxy in 3D.
3D, so you really moved upscale right away, right?
Yeah, and I think that's part of the backstory of why these Main Street single-screen theaters are closing. I mean, the owners have come to a crossroads where they either have to invest, you know, $250,000, or they have to close their doors. Because for a while, the movie studios made their shows, continued to make them available on film. But now, you cannot get a show on film. You have to have digital capabilities. And the projector itself was $90,000. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of scary. And so if you don't have 8,000 people in Webster City, everybody putting in their dollars and pennies and everything they have, you can't have the kind of money it takes to reopen it.
Who did you buy it from?
We bought it from the bank. Wells Fargo had it.
I see.
We made some phone calls, and so they were we were able to get it at a very good price. You know, it took a while, but we were able to get it, and that, you know, that was the first big step. And a lot of people were like, I don't know if you can do it. Well, we have, and so now the next thing is, will they continue to support it by coming? And your earlier guest was talking about the price of getting the movies and the price of concessions, and we're really trying hard not to price gouge to make it not just affordable to be here, but really also to have an atmosphere where people go, that's where I want to go on Friday or Saturday night or on Sunday. We're showing a family movie through tomorrow night, Dolphin Tale 2, and the turnout from the community has just been astoundingly supportive, and so that makes us real hopeful that we're going to be able to keep this thing open and going.
Well, this sounds like a really heroic story. So thank you so much for telling us this, Carrie. Do you have any more questions you'd like to ask?
Well, I just wanted to clarify. It's mostly volunteers who do all the work up there. Is that right? And that keeps it open?
It was volunteers who raised the money, and the board is a volunteer board, but we have paid staff now.
That's great. That's
yeah,
great.
And that's one of the things that the board wanted, was to create jobs. And I think we can do it. I mean, you know, we're looking at the cash flow, and I think we can do it. But, you know, it's still early days. We've been open 3 weeks. But I think that it's going to go. It's pretty exciting, and the community is really behind it. And truly the experience of coming to a movie here compared to coming to a movie at a multiplex, it's a completely different experience. We have the largest screen in Iowa in a single screen theater, and our facility is clean. It's, you know, a whole Art Deco feel as you walk in. Our employees are in uniforms, and it really is like a step back in time to that graciousness that they talked about at the Circle Theater and at the Camelot. I mean, and that's an experience worth experiencing. And if you have to wait a week to see a movie so that you can have that experience, we're really hopeful that families will do that.
Well, thank you. That sounds great.
I'm trying to picture those people at the theater in uniform. Yeah. It's been a long time since I've seen an usher in uniform. That must be a nice touch up there, and yeah. I'm so hopeful that will fly in Webster City. And right now, it sounds like the community is really behind that. They're booking movies that are family-oriented, so they're going to have a wide base of people to come. And I hope the people of Webster City really see that this is not only a theater, but also a symbol of recovery and sustaining a community after a profound cultural shock with a large employer closing down. So sounds to me like Webster City is signing on to this project, and the theater has every possibility of being a success, and I really am behind that whole idea. So thank you, Carrie. That was a wonderful, wonderful story.
Yes.
spaces between us. You have come to show you. Go on. Near, far, wherever.
Our next stop 4 years ago was the Sierra Theater in Jefferson over in Greene County. We spoke with Chris Henning from the Jefferson Chamber of Commerce, who told us how it had opened. Jefferson's story makes the transition sound simple, though she's very clear about the money they had to raise. Here's her account of how the Sierra successfully met its financial challenges through forming a nonprofit.
We are showing first-run movies and movies daily on big screen digital 7.1 surround sound, and we even have matinees on Saturday and Sunday.
Wow, that really harks back, because I remember those Saturday matinees. And you have a lot of people who come for the matinees?
It depends on the movie, what kind of crowd you get, whether it is us oldsters out to see a 100-foot journey just recently, or whether it is the latest version of Hunger Games or the Twilight series or The Hobbit. And we do midnight movies if it warrants it, or 10 o'clock p.m. if the studios will let us, and all sorts of fun things. So are really, really happy with the way things have turned out.
Well, you said you were community-owned. Now, did you have a long period that where you didn't have a movie theater like Boone and like Webster City, or how did that go for you?
Actually, we worked with the previous owners, the Fridleys, and we set a date, got things all squared around for the upgrade, and we were in the changeover from 35mm to digital. We were down a whole 3 days. So no, we didn't have a very long blackout period, and we opened Twilight within 10 days of coming up into the digital world. So it was pretty exciting.
Oh, yes. Now, it sounds, though, like you must have huge audience support there in Jefferson.
We have really good community support. We were able to get bridge financing and then do a pledge drive and raise the funds to put in all that new equipment.
Well, congratulations, and I'm so happy for you. Yes, we are so happy for you. Is that right, Paul?
Well, I'd like to congratulate you, because we've heard some really scary numbers on how much that equipment costs, so you must really have had a successful fund drive and pledge drive there in Jefferson. Congratulations to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, the equipment runs somewhere in the neighborhood of $85,000, and including the silver screen, we chose 3D. So anytime there's a movie available in 3D, we work hard to get that.
Thank you, Christine. We've just heard from Christine Henning at the Sierra Theater in Jefferson. We've heard from two movie theaters that kept their doors open through forming nonprofits. The Boone Theater was not so fortunate, but the community supports it in a different way. Here's Wayne Lumbly to tell us the story of a family business with a lot of ongoing community support.
My wife and I, we recently purchased the Boone Theater. We're located at 818 Story Street, right on Main Street in Boone. I was in the military for 37 years, and I recently retired. So now I'm into the movie business full-time. Neither one of us had any clue how to run a movie theater, so we did some calling. We talked to Jim Davies down at the Hampton at the Windsor Theater and got some tips from him, and so we kind of got going. We had a 35-millimeter projector when we first started Brenda works at Hy-Vee. She's a morning cook over there. So neither one of us really had time to spin film or anything, so we decided to take the big plunge right off the bat and get the digital picture. And, you know, it's tough to try to sell. The Boone Theater was owned by a big movie company out of Bethany, Missouri. They went bankrupt, and the movie theater kind of was open, and it was closed for a couple years. It was kind of off and on, and finally it was sitting empty for about a year or so, and then, you know, Brenda and I decided that that might be something we'd be interested in after I retired, and it's kind of exciting. It's a challenge, like Larry and Carrie said. The movie company, you know, they'd get a percentage of your ticket sales, so basically you're relying on the concessions to make your profits and stuff, and, you know, some people buy concessions and some people don't. So one of the things that we're looking at doing here in the near future is we're going to expand our seating area in our movie theater, and then we're also looking at putting a booth-type sitting in the back, three rows of booth-type sitting, so, and we're going to start serving sandwiches like hamburgers and fries and fast food, nacho cheese, some different things to give us a little bit more flexibility in what we're serving the people. You know, I think it's important that the small downtown theaters stay alive, because it just gives the small communities a quality of life that, that I think that we've lost over the years and stuff with these big cinema complexes. So,
yeah, I agree, Wayne. I think you're really making quite a contribution, number one, in keeping the theater open. Number two, you're being creative. You know, what you're describing is a lot of food that you can have that's not normally part of a movie concession. So that's very creative. And just tell me what kind of response you're getting, what kind of attendance is going on, and how you feel about the community's reaction now.
It's kind of hit and miss. When we first started, we were kind of like hit and miss with a lot of movies. A few movies we had maybe 15 people for the whole entire week. You know, and some movies you get, you pack the house out. And we do some first runs. We tried four or five first run movies. The problem with that is, Larry and Carrie were saying, the movie company pay like 65% of your ticket sales when you do a first run movie. So it takes a lot of your profit out right there. So we try to keep everything family oriented. We stay away from R-rated movies as much as possible. I think we've only played one R-rated movie since we've been open, but otherwise we try to keep everything pretty much family oriented. We try to mix the films up based on what's out in the last month or so. We try to stay within 3 to 4 weeks of what's of a new release, so we can get it at a lower price. We seem to be doing pretty good with the older couple, keeping them happy. We haven't really hit the teenage crowd yet, but our main audience right now, we're seeing about age 30 to 60. That's mainly our main age group that's been attending lately. So see a lot of repeat customers coming back, so I think everybody's excited that we're there. It's just just a matter of picking the right movies. So,
well, I think you're doing a good job. Number one, you've got the custom established and reestablished of people coming to a movie theater and seeing a show. You've got your core audience, because you're saying that you've seen some of the same faces come back. Mm-hmm. And you're picking movies with an ear and an eye to seeing what can be done to bring in a audience in the town you are familiar with. So,
how have things gone in the 5 years since you first bought the Boone Theater?
You know, it's still a matter of trying to figure out what's the right movie for what the people want to watch in the community. So sometimes we guess it right, sometimes we don't. So all in all, I think we got a lot of the same customers coming back. It's pretty regular. And then we got some new people moving into the area that are coming to the theaters. But we do a lot of advertising for some of the other businesses in town here on our screens.
So are there any big changes since I talked to you 4 years ago? Well, no, I thought the story was that your daughter is now the owner.
Yes, she is the owner. Yep, Erin. Yep,
okay,
Erin,
so
Roby.
Has she been involved with the theater ever since you bought it?
Well, yeah, she's been working with us ever since we bought the theater, and then now she's been the owner now for the past year already, so she's coming up on her first anniversary. We've acquired a few leaks on the roof, so we're in the process of patching that. Erin's got a GoFundMe app on Facebook, so people are kind of donating to it to try to get her some money to fix the roof on the building. She put out for volunteers through the community. So she's got quite a selection of volunteers to help her out during the week with ticket sales and popcorn, making popcorn and stuff for her. So
keeping the theater going is really a community venture.
It is. She's had quite a few people donating some funds for her to get the roof fixed. If she succeeds, I succeed in my retirement.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Good luck.
All right. Bye-bye.
Last but by no means least, we're back at the Story City Grand Opera House. At the beginning of the hour, Paul, you described seeing movies there when you were a boy. This is the one movie theater that has made the transition with the same owner who's been managing it for years and who brought the stage back long ago. That's the story we'll hear from Todd Thorson now.
Well, Todd, we have a great story in Story City, ironically, and you might give our audience a little background on our fabulous Story Theater and Opera House up there at Story City.
Well, we're winding down our 100th year of operating. It was built in 1913, and we've been celebrating all year with some various things going on. And it's the unique thing about the Story Theater is that it's never closed all these 100 years. So we're pretty proud of that. And it's been nice listening to the other theaters. I'm so happy that these smaller town theaters are making a go of it. So we're going to try to do the same here.
Yeah, it's wonderful that you've never closed. And I, Todd and I have done dog and pony shows up there. We've given tours of the fabulous Story Theater and Opera House. And during that time, I always mentioned that my mother was going to silent movies there in the 20s. And for me to still be going to movies there and the theater never having closed, well, that's a real chain of events that's to be envied. Todd, you might tell a little bit about what the chain of events was, that how you came to own the theater. It's kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, it's the long history of the theater. There's actually been about only 12 or 13 owners in its 100 years. And I took over from the Peterson family, Dick and Virgil, two brothers that were bachelors that came with their folks in 1946, and after Dick had been in the war, and they operated it through 1983 when I took over. And I started helping out there in high school and showed an interest in it, I guess, and went off to college. One day Dick gave me a call, and he was kind of wanting to know if I'd be interested in taking over, and in the process of time, Judge Stories was also starting out, getting going, and we kind of got our heads together, and I was still going to college when I agreed to do this, plus still working at the paper, so I just added that to my plate.
You mentioned Judge Stories was just getting started. What was that?
Well, that's the local theatrical troupe in town here that, of course, Paul's a big advocate for it also, and he's been involved with them, and they formed a local theatrical troupe, and when we fixed the stage up, which that's another story in itself, in 1988, Dick and I put our finances together and our heads together and fixed the stage up, which had been shut down since basically the late 40s, early 40s. So we resurrected the stage and made that so we could put live theater on again. And then Judd Stories came on board that immediately. I mean, they based their kind of their home base out of the theater now since 1988. So that's been a wonderful relationship that we've had with them, too. So
another great thing that's been happening up there in recent years is our storytelling festival held the third weekend of September every year. And Todd's been very kind to cooperate with us in providing a venue for that. Now, we have nationally known storytellers who perform in that festival, and talking with them, and they've traveled all over the world, they love to perform at the Story Theater and Opera House. And so it's really become a great performance venue, and most of my memory as a boy, it was strictly, by that time, a motion picture theater. And as Todd and Dick restored the performance area, well, that's really enhanced the whole. You can put 20 people in the orchestra pit. And so we can do a full Broadway show with, the union on Broadway says 20 musicians. We can get very close to that. So we can put on a full-blown Hollywood production. Todd and Dick installed this wonderful, beautiful curtain. And The backstage is preserved in a unique way. It is on the National Registry of Historic Places. So, as Todd mentioned, it's never closed as a movie theater. And there are just so many wonderful stories we all have in Story City of going to the theater. And I used to bounce around in the back of a 49 Ford and ride up to see Abbott and Costello and Dean Martin and Ma and Pa Kettle. And I still drive up there on Friday nights with that same wonderful anticipation of going to a movie. I just don't bounce around in the back seat or I'd go off the road. But I'm still going to the movies, and I'm so thankful for all of us in Story City that Todd has maintained this and had that unbroken chain. But Todd, you might share with our audience now the fact that movie theaters, as we've heard from our other theater people, it's really in a state of transition. And where are you in that process now?
Well, listening to the other theaters, you know, the obviously Jefferson and Webster City, they've gone the nonprofit route. So that's a whole different way of doing things, and it's a wonderful way to do it. And I, being a sole proprietor here, it's a little more, it's a little bit more of an uphill climb, we'll put it that way. So, and we're also a town of, you know, 3,400 people as opposed to Boone and Jefferson and Webster City are a little larger, as is Nevada. So we have, you know, the population base here, I guess I want to say, for Story City. You run into conflicts with Friday night football and basketball and all the events that this progressive community, as we all know, Story City is quite active. And you run into that with just being open, you know, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Your time gets squeezed a little bit. So we have to do our digital. We know that. And we've been doing a couple live shows this summer that will help with that fundraising. But it's an exciting time. I'm kind of sad to see the film go. I mean, if you go up, you can take a trip back in time when you go up to the booth and watch the film winding its way through the projector and hear the clickety clack of the sprockets. It's something that's going to be it's going to be hard to see that go. You're putting to bed 100-year technology that it's been around a long time.
The Story City Grand Opera has raised the money to go digital, and the stage will be ready for this year's musical for Scandinavian Days, which we'll hear about in a couple of weeks.
We can play some music. I'm really in love with some of this movie music. I love movie music. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1, which we devote to the people, stories, and events of our 7-county listening area right here in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Paul Wearson, together with my co-host, Susan Franson.
Other voices you heard were Marco Basaglia, Cal Halliburton, Larry Sloan, Carrie Rojas, Chris Henning, Wayne Lumley, and Todd Thorson. The selections of movie music you heard were from The Wizard of Oz, Camelot, Titanic, and The Lion King.
Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Well, now, if you enjoyed this show, tell your friends about it and consider becoming one of the 500 families donating $20 a month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses. Though we'd appreciate whatever fits into your budget if you see fit to contribute. Our station is almost completely volunteer-run, and we'd also like to hear your feedback, either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email. We're at khoiradio@gmail.com. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. And if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us once again at 515-292-2878 or at the email address we just listed.
Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.
We say that together.